Hi, I'm Seacoast Media Group reporter Kyle Stucker. We're here today to discuss the topic of relapse. The state and nation's opioid crisis are widely discussed, but as you'll hear from the experts joining me here in the studio, the subject of relapse itself is one that's fairly widely misunderstood. So with me today are four individuals who will share their firsthand experiences working in various recovery support systems, in addition to their own experiences with substance use. So with me here are Ryan Fowler, who works for Granite Pathways at Safe Harbor Recovery Center in Portsmouth, a Manchester Safe Station program, and he is also a member of the New Hampshire Harm Reduction Coalition. In those roles, Ryan's somewhat on the front lines of various efforts focused on helping people access treatment. Dean Lemire works at Harbor Homes as the Assistant Project Director for the nonprofit's Statewide Peer Recovery Support Services Facilitating Organization Grant. He's also a member of the Harm Reduction Coalition and is one of the Seacoast and State's most vocal advocates for recovery pathways and harm reduction. We have Lynn Fuller, a local mother who has two sons in long-term recovery following their participation in the Stratford County Drug Court program. And that experience helped inspire Lynn to create Circle of Hope, which is a family support group in Farmington. She also serves as the family support coordinator for the state of New Hampshire. And here today is also John Udis, who is a licensed drug and alcohol counselor and clinical social worker, who serves as the program director of Addiction Recovery Services, which operates intensive outpatient programs in Portsmouth and Salem. He's also the board president of the New Hampshire Providers Association. So thanks for joining me here today. And I'm going to start things right off with the question we see most on social media, and one of the main reasons why we're here today. Throughout our coverage of the opioid crisis, we're seeing more and more people post online some variation of the same question. Why are so many high-profile members of the local recovery community relapsing or dying, despite the different expansions and recovery pathways and the money that's being directed toward different new treatment programs and organizations throughout our area?
I really do appreciate the expanded access to treatment and these programs that focus on super early recovery, like 28-day programs and things that kind of treat the acute phase of a substance use disorder. But in reality, the way that I see addiction is it's a chronic, health condition that will be present for some for the rest of their lives, and that requires longer than 28 days of treatment. There's a serious lack of things like recovery housing, especially here in Rockingham County. There is, there's a serious push for access to residential treatment, and the way that I see, especially in opioid use disorder, those disorders, come to a head to a point where a person is stable in, outpatient chairs more than detox beds. It's about a continuum of care that doesn't stop when someone completes a 28-day program. And, I see the need for, a wider continuum of care than just, send them to a 28-day program and they're good. I myself visited four of those programs, and it wasn't until the fourth one that I engaged in aftercare and was able to sustain recovery for more than a month or two.
We kind of have a lot of state contracts out there. It's a fluid set of contracts because some get cut. We have experienced a lot of cuts to treatment contracts in this last year, particularly. And yet what we hear is there's more money all the time, which may not really be true, actually. Like Ryan said, focusing on the acute stage of the disease, if you have a lot of people chanting loudly about we need more beds, well, we added 150 beds, I think, in the last 3 years in New Hampshire. But, what people get with a bed usually is like a lot of structure. They build a network within the residential facility. And then after 28 days, which is kind of an arbitrarily set number, usually set by insurance companies for a treatment phase, they have to go somewhere. I had to go somewhere, and I was left to Craigslist to find an apartment that I could afford, which was a bedroom somebody's house who drank, pretty consistently. And that's one of the primary things I went into treatment for. So The supports need to be in place after somebody leaves treatment, or all the dollars we spend on treatment are for naught. You know, people who are trying to initiate their recovery need the same things that all people need. You need safe, supportive housing. You need, you know, to be gainfully employed, which a lot of people entering treatment and recovery services now, you know, they have felonies, which prevents them from getting an apartment or a job that they can actually, you know, pay for an apartment with.
John, can you talk a little bit about what you and your organizations do in some of those outpatient programs to help individuals with that?
Sure. Just to add real quickly to what Ryan and Dean were saying, I mean, the bottom line is that there's still major gaps despite the added funding that's come around, and it needs to be addressed probably in two areas. One, more aftercare, like they were saying, housing that comes for people after acute treatment, and then also the vehicle that we can use to get people into treatment initially is also a major gap. And a lot of the presentations Ryan and I made to fire departments and EMS, they talk about not having a way to help people get to treatment after they administer Narcan to save that person's life, because there's really not a good system to kind of bridge that gap either. As far as what we do in an outpatient program like ours, is it's intensive outpatient, so it's kind of a versatile and diverse treatment setting where we'll get people who want to try recovery sort of for the first time but aren't quite ready to make that leap into a residential program, and sometimes they don't need that. So we kind of help them assess for that, help them stabilize in that way, and if they aren't able to reach the goals and get better the way they want, then we'll help them get to residential or something more structured. And then we also often get folks coming out of the residential program that are coming there for aftercare and some of the more supports that Ryan and Dean were just stressing, because people don't just need 28 days in an inpatient program often. And what we do there is really just provide a supportive, open forum for people to explore what's going on in their lives and what's, you know, fostering the addiction, and then helping them understand that and then learn new skills. I mean, I think that's a big part of what people don't get about why people start using again, is it's not just this, you know, like people just get better after they make the decision. It's a learning process. And anytime a person tries to learn something new, it takes some trial and error, and it takes time.
So as a family member, it's definitely the struggle, you know, to try to understand why or how somebody comes to a setback or a relapse. And, you know, we have to remind ourselves that our people they're not cured. This is a disease. Like Brian said, they're going to have her, and they're just not cured. And that's a really hard concept for families to understand. We have to understand, again, you know, where their level of treatment's going to be and what's going to help be supportive for that person. And we have to educate ourselves and know what those options are. So when our family member's ready for treatment, because they're not ready when we're ready. We're ready on day one, and oftentimes it's takes much longer than that. So we have to, you know, the more educated we become, we know of all these different kinds of programs that are working. My son said to me early on in his active addiction, he goes, I got this. And I said, Chris, it's one in a million habit on their own by themselves without support. I'm sorry, but you're not that one in a million. You need the supports. You need, you know, to learn the skills to find what's triggering and overcome those cravings. So those are all the things that we have to learn as families.
So as far as the opioid crisis and people who have opioid use disorders, I think within the recovery community and within the treatment community, there's this engendered stigma against opioid agonist therapy like Suboxone and Methadone. And so there's this pretty large contingency of the recovery community that is abstinent, and they view people who are not technically abstinent as, some say, not sober, some say less than. And I think that this is a stigma within the recovery community that's killing people and pushing people out of fellowships where they would find support. Basically, any empirical data, any evidence has come out to show that opioid agonist therapy like Suboxone and Methadone increases success rates tremendously. If you bring Suboxone into a community, it cuts the overdose death rate in half. It increases people's chances for success. And I think that this state actually recently has done a really good job of improving access to opioid agonist therapy like Suboxone, not so much Methadone. But it's kind of like there's this culture in recovery that wants to call addiction a disease while simultaneously denying the accepted medical treatment for opioid use disorder. It's kind of this dichotomy that's killing people. And, you know, it's an evidence-based medicine that saves lives. And, you know, kind of setting the goal of abstinence right off the rip is setting people up for failure. But if we can sustain somebody on opioid agonist therapy until they get their life in order and then they taper off, they have a much higher success rate than if it's just abstinence off the rip. Every individual is so different. I know that some people, the medication is the treatment. What it does for the brain chemistry and what it does for them stabilizing their life is the treatment. And anything that supplements that is fantastic. I think what's really important is for individuals to feel connected to a community and have healthy attachments and bonds. And that's the beauty of a fellowship like Smart Recovery or the 12-step fellowships, is that people become connected to people. But because people, you know, less than professional people have the stigma against medications, these people are kind of ostracized out of a community where they could become connected and, you know, really engage with people. Yeah, some people need the additional support, but for some people, the medication is the treatment.
I think, you know, there's kind of a problem with, you know, the available treatment supports and recovery supports maybe not being responsive to the individual realities of the people who are using them. So, you know, for example, you know, when I was trying to access treatment in 2012, it was at the end of, you know, a 13-year kind of career with using alcohol, you know, progressing into more drug use, progressing into injection drug use, and not intervened on at any point except by police, who couldn't offer me what I needed, right? And at the end of that, I was completely hopeless and had a very low opinion, because society did, of my chances of recovery. You know, what I heard out there was that if you put a needle in your arm, you're going to die that way and probably soon. So I believed it. And kind of my first interaction with some compassionate support was when I kamikazed into a treatment center in my backyard in Dover. And I had been calling, I think, 9 treatment providers throughout the state. You know, I didn't have insurance. Medicaid expansion was not around at that time. And I was only trying to find the first most available spot that would take me. You know, anyone who will take me. I didn't have any education about my disease or treatment or recovery, right? So I took the next available spot. And it turned out that worked for me. I was at a high level of readiness, and probably anything that they had offered me would have worked. I was ready to be in recovery and abstinent, you know? And I found my recovery through the 12-step fellowships, you know? And that worked for me. But I'll tell you, for the other 13 people in my round of treatment, that's not what worked. Either dead today in jail or cycling through treatment supports, you know, hanging out on waiting lists. So that's a problem. If you go in for cancer care, which I honestly don't know a lot about, I haven't had it, but what I have heard is that there are a range of options. You are educated on those options. Your family is educated as well. You know, you can make an informed decision about what pathway you want to head in, and not so for people trying to initiate recovery through treatment in New Hampshire. There's no navigating system. You just hang out on waiting lists until you find a spot and hope that that's the right kind of support for you.
And oftentimes people settle, kind of like you were saying, because there's not options widely available, they just jump into the first one that's there. And then sometimes that leads to a poor treatment experience. people getting kicked out or, you know, doing something to sabotage themselves.
So if it's the wrong experience, if it's the wrong support for that person, then they're probably going to be deemed non-compliant. And if it's a state-funded treatment center where there's high demand, you know, non-compliance means you're out the door. And I watched many people just leave with a couple trash bags, more hopeless than when they had arrived, you know. So that contributes certainly to our overdose rate. The highest, the largest population of people who are dying from overdose in New Hampshire are those who have just left treatment and those who have just left jail. If we have a navigating system, some sort of coordinated system that you can access, you know, become educated on your range of options and then handheld to actually get to that that provider, and then followed up with support afterward. I mean, we somewhat have that with Granite Pathways and the Regional Access Point Services, although that contract was suddenly cut last year and is struggling to get back up. So our legislature gets in the way a lot, and including the governor's office.
So I think really what we're talking about, again, is stigma, which is a term that gets thrown around a lot, but it exists at all levels. You know, Ryan was commenting on stigma within the recovery community, where, you know, people sort of cast one another aside based on what treatment option they're going with at the time, which is really unfortunate. There's stigma and discrimination in insurance policies, and the rules that they follow to authorize treatment, which needs to be repaired. And then just within the general public, there's a lack of understanding, which then leads to stigma of what addiction is and what, you know, who this person is that has an addiction becomes less than a person, and this sort of like sick outcast of society. And that really needs to be changed. And the only way to change that is really through dialogue and education about language and what's really going on with people. You know, they're human beings that have a health condition that has changed their body, their brain, their thoughts, their emotions to a point where they are not really making choices a lot of times. They're automatically engaging in very unhealthy activities and behaviors. And it's hard to grasp that, especially when you have frustrations about if it's a family member and how much you care about them and they're not getting better, or you have frustrations about how much money is getting spent on this issue, which really in the grand scheme of things isn't as much as is being portrayed. So it's complicated.
To help kind of break down some of that stigma here, I mean, could some of you talk about your own personal experiences going through recovery and some of the pressures that you've faced?
Yeah, so, you know, I am a person in recovery. I used opioids for a solid 10 years, and I injected drugs for about 5 years at the end of that. And my experience was going through, you know, multiple police interventions, being revived by naloxone 3 times by first responders, going through several detoxes and psychiatric stays at Hampstead Hospital, and ultimately 4 28-day programs. And it wasn't until the 4th stay at a 28-day program when I, you know, applied everything I had learned in those prior attempts. You know, it's not like I went to those programs and had periods of abstinence and didn't learn anything. It was just about applying it. And ultimately, I, you know, I found God and I became connected to a community. I was given an opportunity for gainful employment, and I found reasons to not do drugs. And that for everybody is personal and unique to them. But it's all about finding something to get out of bed for in the morning, whether that's family, friends, loved ones, jobs, hobbies, passions, whatever that is. You know, I met people who, you know, gave me constructive things to do, and I formed healthy bonds and attachments and behaviors to replace the drugs and the alcohol. And so it wasn't until I took this holistic approach of, you know, my community coming around me and supporting me, you know, offering me a safe place to stay and gainful employment, that I was really able to do well.
So before you reach that point, as you're going through those different programs and pathways, I mean, how many points along the way did you think, I'm done, this is going to be the last time, only to end that period of abstinence, to have a setback? And what caused some of those?
There was probably dozens of times when I made firm resolutions that I would never put a needle in my arm again, and I had to throw away all my paraphernalia, I would delete numbers out of my phone, and I'd make firm resolutions. Sometimes I would go to a detox or get myself into a treatment center. Sometimes I would just try to detox on my own for short periods of time. And ultimately, it wasn't ever this catastrophic thing that, you know, flipped the switch in my brain and had me driving to one of the cities in Massachusetts that begin with L. It was, you know, this kind of series of small things that would happen, and all of a sudden a switch would flip in my brain, and I was almost on autopilot doing what I had spent the, you know, 10 years learning to do, which, you know, ultimately, like, I'm somebody with co-occurring mental health conditions. And for a lot of that, the drugs and the alcohol were my solution. They were keeping me from taking my own life. They were keeping me, you know, they helped me connect with people. They helped me connect with myself. And drugs were my solution for a lot of that. You know, drugs are very effective and very enjoyable. And people sometimes don't talk about that. But for me, I'm 1 in 10 who have a substance use disorder, and I can't use them safely. You know, the majority of people who use or try drugs probably don't end up like me, and that's hard for somebody in their early 20s trying to get sober who can no longer go to bars and connect with that population. But ultimately, I found people who were mentors and role models for me, and showed me how to be a man.
As a family member, I know in my son's active addiction, it, you know, both of my sons, whether they were incarcerated and came out and had been 30 days, 60 days, and they hadn't used, and they're determined they're not going to use, and I believed it. I believed it every time they walked through my door. Unfortunately, they didn't find the supports that they needed at the time, so they did have their setbacks. And I can remember asking myself, when am I going to know? When is this going to be real? When is he going to walk through that door, and I'm going to know I have my son back? I didn't have the answer for that. Today, I can tell you that answer is, you know, when you know, and I know, because our conversation was different. The behaviors were different. My son started talking about being honest with himself and being honest with other people, and that was foreign language. I had never heard this kind of conversation come from him. So those were some of the tools and the skills that he got through the drug court program to help him with his recovery. So that, I think, is important, because every time we want to believe that this is the time, but we still have to look for those behaviors as well, so we don't set ourselves up for failure as family members.
I think part of the problem with the topic of relapse is there's a lot of drama around it that may contribute to making relapses worse than they have to be. You know, I mean, addiction is often talked about as a chronic relapsing disorder, right? Somebody like me, I haven't had a relapse yet. You know, I kind of set a goal that I was going to be abstinent. You know, I'm a slave to nicotine. when my first child was born, I switched to a vaporizer, which I use chaotically, you know, like, you know, substance use disorder is kind of on a range, and it goes from mild to heavy and chaotic. And I'm on the chaotic end of the range with my nicotine use disorder. And yet I'm not shamed for that. I'm not cut from services if I were to test positive for nicotine, right? So I think, you know, it's certainly the case that a lot of people who may go out drinking or use even heroin or fentanyl, you know, once or twice, that what makes that worse, what makes that progress into chaotic use again, is that, you know, the general community and the recovery community will kind of shut them out, right? They could lose a job, they could lose whatever treatment they're receiving, and they could use some of the social connections or the trust of their parents, or, you know, get kicked out of housing, certainly. Especially if it's publicly funded, you lose everything that made recovery possible for you. So, of course, what else are you going to do but continue to use, you know, to be okay, which is the only reason that I ever used drugs or drank alcohol, was to feel okay, because I needed something more in my life. So I think, you know, as a country and certainly as a state in New Hampshire, we're a little obsessed with the idea of abstinence. That's kind of where the Harm Reduction Coalition comes in, to help educate people around the idea that a support can only be effective if it's responsive to the individual needs and realities of the person you're serving. So enter syringe services programs. Enter potentially safe consumption spaces. You know, anyone who's looking for some sterile syringes, some free naloxone, and some compassionate, non-judgmental support can call or text 207-370-7187. And we tend to be really responsive to people and getting them what they need according to their own self-defined goals. If we have a goal of abstinence for everybody, first of all, there's a problem with setting a goal for somebody, you know? So, of course, we don't want somebody to go out and use fentanyl and potentially die. And yet, having that goal for somebody has no effect on whether they're going to suddenly snap out of their disease or not. If we help people to set more reasonable goals, such as using a clean syringe, not sharing syringes, not using alone. Yes, have that Narcan party, as if there were such a thing. You know, make sure that the people that you're using with have naloxone and know how to use it so that we can prevent totally preventable overdoses. You know, there's a range of ways that we can approach people to help them kind of into the fold of society and better decision-making than just insisting that people commit to abstinence before we offer them any help.
Because it's really important as a treatment provider perspective, too. The drama around relapse is such a huge issue and creates more stigma. And as a treatment provider, I've worked at multiple other programs before I got to Addiction Recovery Services, where it was a small organization, and we were able to sort of craft the philosophy and approach in a much more supportive and non-judgmental way. That was what would happen. If someone used again, we would treat it like, you know, it was the end of the world. And I was always struggling with that, like, this isn't going to help them. This is shaming. This is going to make the relapse 10 times worse by treating it that way. So now, you know, as a provider, it's important for me, and I teach people this through supervision too, to when someone is having that problem, you don't react that way. They're already reacting that way themselves, that it was a catastrophic event. So we provide them with the opportunity to sit down and have a calm, objective conversation about what happened so that they can then learn from it instead of, you know, showing them the door. So that was just a really important point that I wanted to emphasize.
How do you balance the accountability that has to come in these programs and in these different organizations with that support?
So it's a very delicate balance, like you're saying. I mean, the reality is what I found the best approach to do, and what many of the clinicians that I work directly with have found the best approach, is that there's accountability still in the idea that that person even comes back and tells you that happened. That's a piece of accountability. And then having that honest, objective conversation about it, and then identifying what they're going to do next to get back on track, is a huge piece of accountability. The other approach really ends up fostering dishonesty and the person's unwillingness. They don't want to be shamed. And again, they're already reacting to it catastrophically internally. So if they think they're going to come and tell a treatment provider about it and they're going to get shamed and confronted, a lot of times they're just not going to tell anybody about it. And that's another way for that, you know, episode of use or relapse to grow even more. So there's still accountability to them coming and being honest with you about what happened, and then accountability to helping them identifying next steps. And we're just sort of facilitating that by having a really supportive, encouraging conversation around it. And then, you know, there's degrees to it too. Does the person come back and admit, I've been using for a month this whole time I've been here and I've finally gotten the courage to admit that? There may be a different response than when the person comes in on Monday morning and says, Saturday night, I had one episode of use. So you have to kind of take all these various factors into account and then use that to help guide the person more, not slam the door in their face.
Every time we report on proposals about different clinics coming to the area, there's a general outcry. I don't want it here on the street. I don't want it in my city or anything like that. How does that really play a role in perpetuating some of that?
Everyone reads a book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, and we don't know what to expect with this. And it wasn't going to happen in my backyard. It wasn't going to happen in my family, and it did. I decided that my son is worth it. Both of my sons are worth it. And I wasn't going to shame them anymore because they're good people and I'm proud of them and I love them. So I had to look, I had to first understand the disease and then talk about it. And I live in a small community and the conversation happens. And I had to put my chin up and say, you know, they like talk about this druggie and that druggie. I said, well, you know, you just made reference to my son. Oh, I would never say that about your son. Oh, my gosh, Lynn, I love you and I love your son. Okay, well, you just did. So not being defensive, but kind of having that conversation. And then before you know it, we're having a conversation and they're like, I had no idea. I didn't understand this and I didn't understand that. So by me educating myself helped to educate others. And the conversation does change in the community. I still get some of the backlash, and I have to respect people's opinions. But when you make it personal, it changes things for people. I've had people, I have a hair salon in my house, I've had people sit down in my chair and say, you know, you talk about this addiction and this, why are you talking about it? And I told them why I was talking about it. And then at the end of the conversation, wow. You know, it does go beyond just the person, and it goes in trickles down the whole entire family and the whole community. So it is important to talk about.
So you'd say it's a general lack of that firsthand knowledge that it's not an issue that's intimately close to these individuals. So it's, whether it be snap judgments or generalizations or assumptions are kind of driving that stigma.
And then when our families come to the group, they all walk in with that shame and, you know, they don't want to talk about it, but let me tell you what, and if you go to a family support group, from the time the person walks in the first time till after 3 months, they want to talk everywhere. They want to tell people about it because they want the help. They want to support these organizations and these voices that are out there. They're forced to be reckoned with, our families. We're working to save our kids' life, which is what we're put on earth to do.
One quick point about the it's not my backyard mentality that's pretty simple to make to people is it's already in your backyard, right? So would you rather it be there in a hidden way with the person not getting any help and potentially creating much more havoc and chaos in your backyard? Or do you want it in your backyard with people getting some kind of guidance and assistance that might steer them out of it?
As far as the issue being in the backyard, you know, there's all these politicians that call New Hampshire ground zero for the opioid epidemic. We have a large population of injection drug users who are cast into the shadows, who are walking your streets, who are living next door. And the beautiful part about some of the volunteer work I do with Dean is with Hand Up Health Services is that we're able to meet people where they're at, potentially in your backyard. You know, we meet people and we provide services. We operate a mobile syringe service program. And through that, we're educating people on safer use, keeping people alive, keeping people free of communicable diseases, because dead people don't recover. And in doing that, in the past few months, you know, I've referred people to healthcare that ultimately saved their lives. There's been some, you know, referrals to treatment that otherwise the people who are actively using, you know, aren't encountering people like Dean and myself unless we're going out and meeting them in the streets where they're at and providing them with measures of harm reduction. I sit here alive and with a clean bill of health because of syringe service programs and people who introduced harm reduction to me at, you know, at a point in my life that was really critical. And yeah, it's important to meet people where they're at and expand the continuum of care. Conditions for care shouldn't start with abstinence. That's like an unrealistic goal, like we've already talked about.
So talking a little bit more about harm reduction and what can be done to improve really what's not only what's out there for individuals who are actively in different stages of addiction or recovery, but also to increase the level of prevention overall right now. What do you think could be done?
Harm reduction is so broad. I mean, Hand Up Health Services that Dean and Ryan are so intimately involved with is a huge piece of that. And having more citizens and people who just want to support and help people, even if they're still actively using, understand that they can get better and give them that kind of hope is important. And it can be done in a lot of ways through things like Hand Up Health Services, you know, through this conversation, through treatment programs, using a philosophy similar to what I described for addiction recovery services, where we don't shame people, you know, as soon as they're having any kind of a problem again. And access to medication, access to clean syringes, whatever form that comes in. Narcan has been a huge piece of harm reduction that people have embraced finally, which, you know, it seems hasn't necessarily decreased the number of overdoses, but lessens the how frequently people die from them if they have access to Narcan within their homes. A big missing gap that I referenced earlier still is what happens when someone has an overdose event and then that space between them getting any kind of service still. So a piece that we've talked about and Ryan and I have been trying to work with some people on is working with EMS and first responders or police stations even to have a bridge for that person that overdoses to be, you know, checked in with, maybe offered hand up health services, resources, or offer treatment resources until they're ready. So just accessing people who are still actively using is a huge part of harm reduction.
I think the harm reduction is huge, and I love the work that's being done, and that's what's happening right now. I think the prevention is a piece that we really need to take a lot of consideration into in our youth. We have a lot of kids that are living in active addictive homes, and they have no supports and no direction to go in. And I know for Mama, it was pretty lonely for me. I can't imagine a 10-year-old son or daughter. So we really need to pay attention to that. Our schools need to have conversations. People need to have more conversations and support these kids.
Teach them, I think particularly when we're talking about prevention, teaching kids the kind of coping skills that we teach people for their recovery before they even become addicted. So teaching kids is not even necessarily talking to them directly about drugs and alcohol and how bad those are, because we've kind of seen how that hasn't necessarily worked wonders over the years, but it's about teaching them it's okay to talk about things, it's okay to talk about how you're feeling, what's going on with you, and it's okay to, you know, learn different tools to cope with how you're feeling, whether it's teaching them to do short meditations or teaching them to even just have the language to describe their emotion. There's a lot of things that we teach people in a treatment group, you know, when they're 25, 30, 45, sometimes 65 years old, that we should be teaching kids when they're 7, maybe even younger.
Harm reduction is prevention. It's prevention of, you know, an impending HIV outbreak in New Hampshire. You know, there was a study of injecting drug use in Stratford County a couple of years ago that I was involved with, doing the interviews, you know, 90-minute interviews with people who at that time were injecting drugs. And, you know, researchers who looked at the study said that conditions for injecting drug users in New Hampshire are as bad as any third world country. You know, and that was only, you know, less than 2 years ago. And, you know, we've certainly got some more services and some better messaging, some more people on board with the idea of, you know, compassionate care for people who use drugs since then. But it's not enough. We need to start these things about 20 years ago and should have a little bit more patience with the situation. As the supports and kind of the thinking about addiction catches up. But, you know, like Lynn said, or I think John said, like, you know, recovery is prevention. It's all the same stuff if you're doing it right. If we think of primary prevention, which is, you know, up to somebody starting to struggle with drugs, usually we're focusing on school-age kids. If we think of prevention as just you know, trying to instill a better decision around just drugs, we're going to fail. And that was part of the president's talking points in his plan that he released on Monday was, you know, we're going to spend a lot of money on an ad campaign such that we had, you know, under President Bush one. And we know that that usually had an adverse effect, especially for the most high-risk kids who were now attracted to doing something that that adults disapproved of, you know? You know, part of his plan was also, you know, just restricting the supply of opioids, you know, prescription opioids in this country, I think, by 2/3 in 3 years, which, you know, those of us kind of following the story understand that the reason that we had a heroin and then a fentanyl crisis was because a lot of people who had been getting prescription pills, either legally as prescribed or not, were suddenly cut off when they showed signs of substance use disorder and were not followed up with any other options, right? Prevention is about giving people other options rather than drugs to enjoy their lives and to cope with stress, which we have, you know, our kids are under a lot of stress lately.
I think it's important, too, to know that, you know, we've come a long way. We've got a long way to go. There's no doubt we have a long way to go, and there needs to be more conversation and more change. But I think it's important for everyone to know we have come a long way, and we need to keep this momentum going. It doesn't have to be just so discouraging. A lot has changed.
And so we talked a little bit earlier about one of the things that really inspired this chat here today, what we're seeing being posted out there, being shared in the community, discussed in the community. And as I alluded to, part of that is due to the fact that there have been a number of individuals who are fairly well known in the recovery community, whether they've been faces of different organizations or just individuals that have provided different assistance or served as figureheads or spoken out in different capacities. I'm just wondering if you could, again, just kind of address things directly there in terms of the pressures that come with that type of situation. I know, obviously, there are programs that are based on keeping individuals anonymous. Obviously, speaking out about your personal stories raises awareness and helps foster that understanding in the community of what these issues are. How do you, as individuals in the recovery community providing those supports, balance those two things between using your stories and encouraging and empowering individuals to share their stories without setting them up to fail or putting them in a high pressure situation where the moment they have even the slightest of setbacks, they're opened up to toxic social media reaction?
Well, it has to do with what Dean mentioned earlier, and I piggybacked off of people's like putting that kind of pressure on someone when really what's the most important thing is they're dealing with a chronic health condition, and if something difficult happens to them, judging and shaming for that is not going to do anybody any good.
As a person in recovery, my early recovery experience was learning about, you know, humility, having a sense of self, and realizing that the world didn't necessarily revolve around me all the time. And what I see in New Hampshire, and I won't list any organizations or names, is this kind of tradition of taking young people and kind of putting them in early recovery and putting them on the news or putting them on posters and putting them on TV and kind of putting these young people in relatively early recovery on a pedestal for the world to see. And in my day-to-day life, you know, Dean looks at me everywhere I go because he's on a poster. What I think is important about that, though, is I know that Dean had a firm foundation in his personal recovery, and that was totally appropriate. I can think of other people and other organizations who have kind of become, you know, put on a pedestal and then not learned, you know, that humility and having that foundation of recovery. And then they slip. And imagine being on a pedestal and you slip and, you know, the stigma that's, you know, engendered in that. It becomes very difficult for people to reach out for help. And I know of individuals from my work in Manchester that are out there running around and not doing too well because they have this increased sense of shame because, you know, I was the person on TV and I was on the poster, and now I had a reoccurrence in my substance use disorder, and it's difficult to come back when you've been put on a pedestal. And it results in notable people, you know, passing away, and this, it just increases shame and stigma.
What can be done to help with that?
I think we can do better to change the conversation. You know, I mean, we're in New Hampshire. We're first in the nation for the elections, right? And in 2016, that converged with a really heightening problem with opioid overdoses, right? And so that was our number one issue as voters, and that's what politicians flocked to New Hampshire to talk about, whether they had any understanding about addiction or not. That's what they were talking to us about, and therefore that's what the reporters were asking us in the recovery community about. And you know, a lot of those interviews that I saw and participated in were really exploitive, you know, and I don't think it was intentionally so. It was, I think the recovery community, which includes our allies, has a lot of work to do still in changing the conversation about addiction and recovery. That it's, you know, it's not really so relevant or interesting how bad it was when we were chaotically using alcohol and drugs. You know, what is interesting is what has worked for us and what may work for others. And it's usually some pretty basic, boring stuff. You know, when we talk about recovery, we need to be talking about affordable, safe housing, which is, you know, diminishing in New Hampshire by the week. It is really expensive to live in New Hampshire. And if you don't have supportive housing, you can't afford to live anywhere but a tent or on, you know, your friend's couch who may be using. I'm sorry, but you don't have a shot. Like, it's that much harder. Right. Getting people in recovery into the workforce, keeping people who are using drugs, who may be struggling still, in the workforce, because that is what that's one of the biggest supports for somebody's recovery. You know, we have this idea that somebody needs to crash and burn and repent in order to enter recovery. And that's just wrong. A lot of that narrative comes from people in recovery, where that is kind of the story that they tell each other and tell themselves, that it had to get this bad before I could possibly enter recovery. And we know that the majority of people in the United States who are living in some type of recovery where they're not chaotically using drugs and, you know, collecting DWIs and, you know, ending marriages, they do so without having crashed and burned. With, you know, they do so without necessarily even having stopped drinking or using drugs, right? But we can move people from chaotic use to moderate use, and have a lot of successes and prevent a lot of, you know, a lot of deaths and, you know, wasted money.
I think as a society, we're very impatient, rushed to judgment, and it's even modeled by a lot of our leaders, and that just promotes addiction. It promotes divisiveness. It promotes stigma. It promotes ostracizing people, which is just going to isolate them and increase addiction. So as a society, learning to be more patient, learning to stop and try to understand what's going on with a person before we assume we know everything about how bad they are, that's going to promote recovery. If we can stop and be more patient and try to understand what's going on instead of just rushing to judgment and criticism and assumptions all the time.
Now we want to know what's working. What's working with the treatment programs, you know. I think if we talk more about that, that's more useful for me as a family or a community at this point. Make recovery look good, yes, because for hope, but more importantly, what do we do when we're faced with this?
I just kind of want to piggyback on what Dean said. There's kind of this commonly held belief and this phrase of somebody has to hit their bottom and somebody has to bottom out. And it's my experience and the experience of those around me that a bottom is not required to access recovery. And, you know, I just really implore people to stop telling people that they have to hit their bottom. Stop defining for people what a bottom is. You know, this is kind of idea that tough love is the way to go about it. Tough love kills people. And how many people have to die because they were told that they weren't at their bottom? And that goes into a reoccurrence, too, or a relapse. If somebody has a reoccurrence of their substance use disorder, don't tell them they have to bottom out again. That's just not the case. You know, and that's just this really kind of common narrative in the recovery community, and it's just simply not true.
Another really dangerous message is, you know, there's nothing that you can do to help somebody. You know, and that's certainly how I felt as somebody experiencing addiction, is there was nothing that I could do after a certain point, and nothing that that anybody else could do for me. And it's all around this idea that somebody needs to crash and burn before they can conceive of a different way, or latch on to any kind of help. You know, there's plenty that people can do, and you know, when we think of treatment, we think of, you know, a bed in some facility with no windows or whatever. We think of a chair in an intensive outpatient program, you know, and a lot of these things like have waiting lists. And so what do you do while you wait? Well, treatment is, we can think of treatment a little more broadly. Treatment is how you treat somebody, you know? If we can provide compassionate care to people and be kind of a face of help, be a helper, be a you know, shoulder to cry on, or just a friendly face walking down the street, you know, people especially who are injecting drugs, really, you know, walk around just experiencing stigma at every interaction, experiencing hatred and disconnection, you know. Anything that we as citizens can do to provide connection to people, it doesn't mean we're going to solve their problem entirely, but we are offering treatment, you know, when we do so.
Yeah, and it's part of the process of changing that dialogue and decreasing stigma. Every interaction, right, can be an opportunity to do that, and all of those small interactions equate to a shift in society and a shift in culture and how we're treating other people.
And for families, I say, never give up. Don't give up. Recovery that is possible, and it does work, you know. And we're not going to give up on our kids. Believe that. Know that. Have it in your heart. Sometimes you may have boundaries that doesn't allow you to be that person that Dean could be for my son. So reach out to the people that are there to do that job. Maybe a mom or dad can't do that job, but a recovery center or another program can.
And I think that's, again, people play different roles. You know, like Lynn was saying, a family member maybe needs to set certain boundaries and have expectations or not have someone live in their home anymore necessarily, but that can also be done while that person has a connection.
Fear, if there's any other points that you wanted to raise at all?
Another thing we didn't mention, and support Medicaid expansion, because it's the single most important policy that has really given people access to services in our state, and there are some heavy opponents to it because of cases like, oh, we've spent all this money on it and it's not working, and they're wrong, and it is working and it's helped tons of people. So, you know, there is hope. People do get better, and one of the vehicles for that in our current system is health insurance, and Medicaid expansion is so incredibly important for that. People need to back that up and keep it in place.
Yeah, the most vulnerable people to overdose and death by overdose in New Hampshire are the Medicaid population. And we've done a really good job in signing people up for Medicaid, which they use until they don't need it anymore. So, you know, 150,000 people, I believe, 125 to 150,000 have signed up for Medicaid in New Hampshire. And there's always a rolling cast of 50 at any given point, 50,000 people. And the reason for that is two-thirds of those people used Medicaid until they were gainfully employed, and were able to get on the exchange or get on their employer's insurance. So it is working. It is doing what it's meant to do. You know, I'm not excited about the work requirement because of that reason. Medicaid expansion in New Hampshire is absolutely essential to build on what the foundation that we've set in these last 3 years to provide a safety net for the most vulnerable people.
And I'll just say that, you know, my trip to treatment that ultimately saved my life was made possible by Medicaid expansion. If it wasn't for state funding and then Medicaid expansion covering my stay in treatment, I don't know if I would be alive.
Well, I invite anybody who wants to get involved with the New Hampshire Harm Reduction Coalition or want to start a syringe services program in their backyard, they can visit nhhrc.org. and email info@nhhrc.org.
I think the recovery community centers are a great place a lot of times for people to start to inquire about resources, and particularly for this area, Safe Harbor and the Regional Access Points program that Ryan works with. And then I spend a good part of my job at this point just helping people connect to resources that might help them that isn't necessarily our program. So look up Addiction Recovery Services online. It's an intensive outpatient program in Portsmouth and Salem. We got a website. They can email, call, or text us. And I will, you know, go out of my way to take the time to connect someone to some resources that will help them.
For families, I say we have 13 family support groups in the state of New Hampshire right now, with more growing. You'll see more family support groups starting because the need is so extreme. And I say walk into a family support group. Something will happen to you that will change your life and give you hope and coping skills. And the most important thing that you're going to know is that you're not alone. Oftentimes families walk in, they think they're going to get the answer. They walk through the door, they're going to get the answer that's going to fix their person. You learn other things. You know, you learn how to fix yourself. So that's really important. Anybody wants to know anything about the family support groups in New Hampshire, my name is Lynn Fuller. You can email me at hopeforfamilies123@gmail.com.
My message is that, you know, any empirical data, any evidence, any research, and any successful drug policy will show that punitive measures for using and sharing drugs don't work. We need to invest in treatment and compassion and evidence-based approaches. Anytime I see a drug problem, I see a drug war problem. I think that, you know, the path that the nation needs to go in is ending the war on drugs and showing people compassion, pulling people out of the shadows and out of the black market. You look at countries like Portugal, Canada, Germany, the UK. They've substantially decreased their drug problem by, you know, doing away with punitive measures. And, you know, there's that. And then my plug is that, you know, I work at Safe Harbor Recovery Center in Portsmouth at 865 Islington Street. It's a peer-led recovery center. We honor all paths of recovery. Anybody experiencing any issues with substance or alcohol use can come in Monday through Saturday. And, you know, there's plenty of volunteer opportunities, plenty of ways to get involved and help. I think a lot of people listening probably feel like a passerby or like a voyeur. There are opportunities for you to help in this crisis. So get involved at your local recovery community organization. And then the other one, too, is the Regional Access Point Services line. If anybody right now is experiencing any level of substance or alcohol use issues or is experiencing that through a loved one, they can call 1-844-711-HELP or 4357. And that, you know, anybody can call, and that's a good access point to services, resources, or treatment.